Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Okay, hello and welcome everybody to the Chakroy Meditation Podcast. Today, I'm really delighted to be joined by a beautiful yoga and meditation teacher, Kadeen Morecambe. Now, I met Kadeen in May when she was hosting a beautiful yoga retreat in Morocco, just outside Marrakesh, earlier this year. And she and her partner are actually incredibly wise and have this beautiful way of teaching yoga and teaching the wisdom around yoga. Now, Kadeen has just completed a master's degree in yoga and the traditions. And we're going to talk about her specialist subject today, Kadeen. So welcome and thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Roseanne. It's great to join you and nice to see you after all the time. Yes, so we're going to talk about the Dasha Mahavidyas today. So this is a course that I run, a one-year immersion. I actually didn't write about them in my master's degree. I thought all the way through the degree that I would, of course, write my dissertation on the goddesses, but I didn't in the end. So that's another subject, maybe something we can talk about another time. I wrote about the role of sleep in yoga and meditation traditions.
Oh, wow. But, excellent.
Yeah, yeah. So, but the Mahavidyas, so they are tantric deities, goddesses. There's 10 of them in this form, although earlier incarnations may have had more. There are different references to having more of these goddesses, but the incarnation that we're talking about now, the 10 goddesses that come together, came together around about the 10th century. So what they are we could say the 10 goddesses together make up the formation of the whole of reality as it is. They're being represented through these 10, you could say, archetypal forms. And so what I do with this course basically is introduce people to the 10 goddesses, and we'll go through we spend a month to 6 weeks with each goddess. So I run the course over a year, and what I'll do with each goddess is we'll have a meetup session where we go through learning about her iconography, her mythology, her symbolism. We do some practices with her, mantra and meditation practices. And then I kind of send you off on your way for that month or 6 weeks, and I send you lots of practices over that period of time. So we use the characteristics of the goddess to essentially inquire into ourselves. Okay, so that's a basic introduction to what we do with them.
Okay, so I mean, it's, we all know, you know, the term goddesses is so widely used now. You know, you just meet your friend and you go, oh, you're absolute goddess, you know, and you're feeling fantastic. And as I was just explaining to you before, I went on a goddess weekend recently, which was really just embracing and understanding all the sort of the basic feminine archetypes that we have within us, you know, like the mother and the crone and so on. But this is taking it to a whole new level because this has got all that yogic tradition behind it. And understanding the goddesses, I mean, is this presumably relevant to all life, to all people, and it's not just a female archetype, or is it?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because often there is a sort of misconception, I think, around what we call the divine feminine. And, you know, it's wonderful that it's being used in a way that is empowering women. I know there's lots of teachers out there using this as a form for, specifically for female practitioners, to get to know themselves and feel empowered within a female form. But the Mahavidyas and the divine feminine, as we would refer to it in the tantric tradition, is exactly that. As you say, it's open to all people. So it's not that we are separating male and female. And I often like to make the distinction between feminine and female. So there is a feminine quality, of course, here, and we can talk about what that feminine quality is as Shakti, as power. But it is all life is infused with that feminine force, essentially. Yeah. So I do have men coming on the course. It's predominantly women, because I think women are attracted immediately to that idea of the goddess. So I would say probably in my groups, it's probably 80 to 90% women who are on there. But yeah, I do have a few forward-thinking men who are brave enough to join, so that's good. But yeah, absolutely, we're looking at something, because inherently this tradition is what we would call non-dualistic. So if we start separating male and female, we're creating a dualism there. So we're looking to have an experience that is non-dualistic, which, in other words, encompasses everything.
And how do, so we, in your learning about all these various goddesses, of which I think I was looking up, I had a good look at them before, and I think there's probably only two names on this list that I recognize. So there's Kali, and then there's Kamala, the ones that I recognize. And then Tara, I don't know, but it's a normal name, so I kind of like, that sounds familiar. But are the archetypes ones that we would be familiar with without even knowing about it? Or is it what they represent that is perhaps familiar to us?
Yeah, and what they represent. So between the 10 goddesses, we have a representation really of all elements of, we could say, human experience, but all experience. So there's definitely those archetypes that we will recognize, such as you mentioned, the crone. That's a very common archetype when we're talking about the divine feminine. And that would be represented in one of the Mahavidyas called Dumavati. She certainly represents the crone. But they are essentially, they're goddesses. So the creation of them as a group through the tradition of Tantra. So the Tantra tradition is something that arose in South Asia, and it kind of came out of, influenced by Vedic tradition and ascetic tradition as well. And what the Tantras are, essentially they are texts called Tantras, but it was a way of approaching, I guess we would say the term religion now, but actually practices. And so there would be actual, you could say, manuals called tantras that describe particular practices, and they're very much based around relationships with deities. So with the goddesses, we have what's called, they're in a tradition of Shakta Tantra. So this is the Shakta, meaning, or we know Shakti, this term meaning power. So this is the feminine quality of consciousness. So we have this Shiva Shakti paradigm, where we have the deity Shiva we're familiar with, this god, and then we have Shakti, the feminine counterpart, and this is between them. This is kind of the whole of reality, is this interconnection between Shiva and Shakti. It's more manifest in form, and Shiva is more what we might think of as the formless reality.
I think that most people will recognize those names, the Shakti and Shiva, as the, you know, the Shakti at the base, at the root, you know, when I'm looking at it in chakra terms, you know, sitting at the root, and then the Kundalini rising up to meet Shiva at the crown. So that's, I think, where it turns into a kind of more familiar territory. But I love the carry on, because I love your explanation. I'm already learning.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is part of what is explored within. I mean, Kundalini is a really useful way to approach the goddess, because this is essentially the kind of power of the goddess within our own body, is Kundalini Shakti. So we can experience that through the yogic body, and as you're very familiar with the series of chakras and nadis, these channels. So this is one way that we experience the goddess. And she rises, you know, we get this rising Kundalini up, and we can have this movement up and down of Kundalini. But I think we were talking about, you were asking about the archetypes and the different goddesses and how you how you recognize them.
Yeah.
And what we have here is the reason we've got these goddesses, they've come together, is in part the interaction between what we have with Buddhism and, for want of a better word, I'm going to say Hinduism, but that's a whole other dialogue we could get into, because that's a modern creation of the term Hinduism that came out of colonialism. Because when we go back to this era where we have the Mahavidyas created, we just have different sects of Shaivas, so people who worship Shiva, Vaishnavas, Vishnu worshippers, and Shaktas, so people who worship the goddess. And we have Buddhists, and we have Jains within India. So we have different traditions. Later on, a lot of these things merged to become Hinduism. So when I use the term Hinduism, I'm just bearing that in mind, just because it's a convenient term. But I am aware that Hinduism didn't exist as a term at that time. So within this tradition, what happened, we sort of get a decline of Buddhism in India, and some of these goddesses get appropriated into the Mahavidyas. So there's a little bit of a mixed, an intertwining of goddesses from what we would say is Hindu tradition and Buddhist tradition. So you mentioned Tara, because you know that name. So she is, and a lot of people will be very familiar with Tara, as a Buddhist bodhisattva goddess. So green Tara and white Tara, they're very popular Buddhist deities. So we have this goddess Tara appearing in the Mahavidyas. Her form looks quite different, and it has been argued between scholars whether or not it's the same goddess, but her mantra is a Buddhist mantra, so she's clearly been taken from the Buddhist tradition and put into this tradition. And we could say that these things happen partly to, there can be an assertion of dominance through different tradition. It's like, oh, that tradition has that goddess, but we'll take that so we can have her too. So it's quite interesting to watch when we delve into the history of religion in South Asia and yoga traditions, how there is a lot more interaction between these traditions than we would otherwise think. We think of Hinduism as being one thing and Buddhism as being another. But a lot of the practices that come through these traditions, particularly through the Tantra roots, are kind of shared. So we get shared deities. So Tara is shared between Buddhism and Hinduism via the Mahavidyas. Chinnamastar, another one of the Mahavidyas, is very much, she's a Buddhist deity as well. And interestingly, she appears in the first Hatha Yoga text as well, which was in recent years proven to be a Buddhist text. So the tradition of Hatha Yoga was always considered to be a tradition that came out of the Shaiva tradition, Shaiva Tantra, but the first text, the Amrita Siddhi, was a Buddhist text. And part of the reason they know it was a Buddhist text, because at the time it was written, we have this opening paragraph dedicating to Chinnamastar. So it's quite interesting. So we get what we get with, and this is what I really love, because I'm interested in all South Asian soteriology, these traditions that lead to freedom. I'm really interested in the interaction of these traditions, and that they're not completely separate, because actually what I like to practice is something that leads me to a non-dual state. And it's really interesting to sort of see these traditions in a sort of non-dualistic way as well, that actually they're not completely separate. Yeah. So there is this appropriation of goddesses and this mix of goddesses, and some of the goddesses, they have early prototypes in more indigenous goddesses that you would say are a local goddess to a particular area of India. So some of the characteristics of that goddess get appropriated into the Mahavidyas. And I think it's a kind of way of unifying different areas and different practices into one to bring them together. So for instance, the deity Matangi, who is one of the Mahavidyas, she has an early prototype in a goddess called Meenakshi, which is a South Indian goddess. There's a really well-known temple to her in Madurai, in Tamil Nadu. And she is a goddess who's kind of arisen out of this Dravidian tradition, this South Indian tradition. So it's kind of separate from the original Vedic tradition as well. So there are basically these goddesses come together, and they kind of take little bits from maybe a really well-known local deity and bring characteristics from older deities within the Vedas as well, get appropriated into some of these goddesses. So there's a real sort of mix of what we meet in them. So yeah, it's very interesting in that. And then when we meet all these sort of mixed characteristics, overall, what we meet is different ways of approaching a practice for us to have some form of self-realization.
Yeah. So this is what I wanted to get into. So we're studying a goddess. Now I'm going to take the goddess of this list of 10 that I feel I know the best, and I probably know about 0.5% of what she represents. And again, another goddess that people may well have heard of more is, which is Kali. So Kali has, you know, she is dark, she is death and rebirth, and she has, you know, she's got skulls and blood, and she's not a pretty picture. And actually, what is interesting is when I did a quick scan of like reading up about, well, you know, just a quick one, and I was like, God, they all come out with really bad descriptions. They're like, you know, they got disheveled hair and three eyes, and they're, you know, gnarly skin or dry, or like they are not pretty. I mean, goddesses that we think of as like, ah, ta-da, beautiful beauty queen goddess, this is not that at all. So anyway, we'll come back to that. But it's interesting because having sort of connected with this goddess Kali, I can see the strength that she's given me. Like she's got her club for strength and the, you know, staff to keep the fear at bay. And she's got, what's she got else? She's got a severed head. just for fun, to remind you of rebirth, the ego death, all of that. And then a cup, which I believe was for the, you know, for spiritual growth, you know, in the description, it's just like, she's got a cup of blood, you know, great. That sounds really entertaining. You know, she's pretty gnarly, but like all of those things together are really, so do they all have similar kind of symbolism? Like what are the kind of lessons that they learn? Do they, that they learn us, that they teach us, are they all have something separate to teach us, or is it as a whole that they have more to teach us?
Well, it's a bit of both of those things. There are definitely different things that we'll meet through each goddess, but there are some themes that come back again and again. So the overall theme is to essentially point us towards our true nature. So to kind of recognize ourselves as part of the bigger whole, we could say. And interestingly, you mentioning Kali, so she's the first goddess of the Mahavidyas. And she's kind of considered in a way to be the mother of the Mahavidyas. And in some stories, she kind of gives rise to the Mahavidyas. So she's in a way a prototype for the rest of the Mahavidyas to come out of, but they are all quite individual as well. So we get different characteristics. So we meet Kali first, this really awesome goddess who, like you say, she has all these characteristics that can, if at first glance, if we look at an image of Kali, she seems very fierce and fearsome, and maybe she might invoke fear in someone to see that. I often think, because I've got images of all of these goddesses in my house, and I've got a teenage daughter who has friends coming around, I think I've got no idea what they think when they see all these images of these goddesses with like heads in their hands and you know, a garland necklace of heads and things like that. But yeah, there are similar iconography that comes in through a lot of the goddesses representing their forms. So, for instance, we commonly meet in pretty much all of the Mahavidyas the mudra, Abhaya mudra, which means fearlessness, and Varada mudra, which is this sort of downward pointing hand towards the floor, which is a sort of gift bestowing mudra. So those two elements of iconography are quite useful for us to remind us of what the goddesses are drawing us towards. So they're asking us to be fearless, of course, but they're also kind of bestowing these gifts upon us. So the Mahavidyas are approached for both spiritual realization, so to ultimately become free, but traditionally, they've also been used to gain siddhis, these magical powers as well. So this gift bestowing mudra can be the gift of gaining powers as well, which is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. So there is, you know, they have been used to gain particular powers that if we look at them from a modern context, we might think, oh, hang on a minute, what's that? So like the power to overcome your enemies is a common theme that comes up sometimes, but I always approach that, and we look at that actually the primary enemy that we experience as a spiritual practitioner is this kind of getting caught up in our own ego, getting caught up in our own mind. This is the real enemy, isn't it?
Yeah, we are our worst enemies, are we not?
Exactly, exactly. So it sounds like we're not trying to smite our neighbors or anything like that, but
yes,
you know what we are trying to do, and that this is what we have in some of this symbolism of Kali. So when we have this garland of heads here, this can represent all these sort of ruminating thoughts, is one of the elements of this symbolism. It also represents the Sanskrit alphabet. There are other elements, but it can represent the different incarnations of life. So we're being guided to some things that we might want to overcome or transcend. And this holding the head in the hand, again, that's often, it's just that severing. It's just an immediate severing of the ego. So we would really associate the ego with the head, wouldn't we? That's gone. It's like, I'm free. So there are very direct symbols that are used in the goddesses. So we get this idea of what their characteristics are and what they're guiding us towards.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
But then we have... So some things do appear again and again. The Tara, her form in the Mahavidyas looks very similar to Kali. So if you, to the untrained eye, people would probably see her and think it's Kali. But there's a few things that you can spot that you can distinguish Tara from. But then we have other goddesses. I'm just mentioning some of the more interesting iconography. This goddess I mentioned earlier, Chinnamastar, she is a goddess who's actually severed her own head, and she holds her own head in her hand. She has two attendant deities with her, and she's basically, where she severed her head, she's got three streams of blood that come out, one into her own mouth and one into these deities that she's feeding next to her, these attendants. So what we have represented here, there are some very direct representations of self-nourishment, of course, and the nourishment of others. But we have, through these three streams, we have this more esoteric representation of the three channels within the yogic body, the Sushumna and Ida and Pingala. And we have this representation of the blood rising up as a rising Kundalini. So there are direct representations that we meet, but there are sort of hidden representations. And this is very typical of the Tantra tradition, that it lays out particular practices, but some of them are kind of closely guarded secrets that you kind of have to be initiated into traditions to really learn, although not so much these days because most information is available to us. But more traditionally, it would require initiation to understand the sort of hidden meanings.
Yeah, to get all the symbolism that's there needs, yeah. You know, because, yeah, your average person would look at that image and think, oh, good Lord, what is going on there? But yes, when you say it like you do, you know, it's very clear. What's coming up for me that I'm interested to know is, and this may be a really basic, stupid question, but these, where do all, I mean, I suppose this goes for every, all deities, whether they be Greek or Roman or Hindu or whatever, where do these deities come from? And how did they come to be? I mean, is it just through mythology, through stories? And I know that they appeared first in, you know, in these tantric manuals, as you call them, you know, these documents. But where were they born from? Where did they manifest from?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the earliest deities that we get within South India is within the Vedas. So the Vedas are the earliest texts that we have. And they're kind of considered to be the base texts that modern Hinduism is based on this Vedic tradition. So the oldest text being the Rig Veda, which current consensus with scholars dates it back to about 1200 before Common Era, so over 3000 years old. So we do get mentions of some deities, none of the Mahavidyas directly, but there are definitely early prototypes in there that we can see that some of the characteristics of the of some of the Mahavidyas have been taken from. So we have deities in those texts, and the Vedas are, so within the Vedic period, these are, they're obviously written down texts, but they would have been transmitted orally originally. Yeah, so they're transmitted, yeah, for a long time. And this tradition was really a sort of ritualized tradition, and often based around the kind of Vedic fire and making offerings into the Vedic fire. So we kind of get this tradition of ritualism. And in that early period, rituals were carried out to, you know, to do, get things like, you know, get a better crop, or, you know, to gain some kind of power within this life. And then what starts to happen in India later on, so when we move from the Vedas, then we get this tradition of the Upanishads and Aranyakas that come a little later, so around the earliest, around about 700 before Common Era, and we start getting a more, what we would think of as more sort of spiritually aspirational, in that it starts to talk about, like, what is the self? We get these kind of questions about what the self is, and we start getting early references to things like the breath, and we even have references to channels. So we start getting things like that in there, and some mention of deities, not in an overt way like the Mahavidyas, but definitely appears. So they kind of slowly appear, and then we have within the, what was the Shramana movement, so this is kind of the birth of Buddhism and Jainism, which is in this area of India, which is modern day kind of Bihar area, but it was called Greater Magadha. We get these movements that start to include in their practices this, the doctrine of karma. So karma being action, and this starts to create this whole system of karma and rebirth. And then this starts to come into these, there's this melding of these traditions together. And then we start getting the growth of, I guess, out of all of this sort of coming together, then we get a direct system that, like the Tantra, that comes out, that starts giving us practical ways to realize this, practical ways to escape the cycle of rebirth as well. Of course, we get that through the Buddhist tradition and Jain tradition in their own ways through meditation practices. But yeah, we start to build something that is a bit more, you know, very direct in its approach to what is it we're trying to achieve. We're trying to achieve moksha or liberation, and how are we going to achieve that? And within that, there's the question about what I am and how we experience I, that is beyond the limited identification of this form that I'm in. So we start getting the explorations of, like, the subtle body starts to come into that as well. So the deities kind of, they form part of this because they represent elements of experience. And what we have here, so when we see an image of a goddess, we see an anthropomorphic image, but actually a goddess or a god, so in particular the goddesses, they're also represented primarily by their mantra. So they will have a mantra, and that is as much their form as this anthropomorphic form that we can look at. So when we chant their mantra, that is basically, it's not the mantra that belongs to the goddess, it is the goddess.
Yes.
And the same with yantras. So these geometric diagrams that we get called yantras, That is the goddess. So it, from our point of view, if we approach it from that the mantra and the yantra is the goddess, maybe we can intellectualize that, but it may be harder for us to immediately relate to this. So these anthropomorphic forms, what they do is allow us to have a relationship, because we can, oh, I can understand that. I can understand elements of iconography. And if I can see an image, then I can develop a relationship with it. But we could also say, ultimately, they're all formless too.
Yeah. Now, I love that. That's such a brilliant, beautiful explanation, because these iconographies, they're the image of these goddesses, they're so intricate and they're so weighted down with so much symbolism that needs decoding and so on. But that helps once, you know, obviously once you know what that symbolism means. But I just love the idea that these goddesses actually just live within the resonance of their own mantra, that they are that resonance. And that must bring them really to life when you're studying them, as you do, and actually brings me on really nicely to my next question, which is going to be like, so we learn about all of these beautiful goddesses and what they hold and their archetypes and their everything that they represent within us, but how do you bring that, you know, you're saying that there's lots of practical practices, so what are those?
Yes, so what I do is we basically will practice various mantras with the goddesses, and they have lots of mantras. So they have what's called a mula mantra, a root mantra, but they also have many other mantras which will have different amounts of syllables within the mantras. They have a bija mantra, so a bija being a seed syllable mantra. So we're familiar with the seed syllable om. That's a bija mantra. So the goddesses have their own seed syllable mantras too. But most of the gods, well, they all have 100 or 108 or even 1,000 named hymns. So these stotras, these hymns, and what they are is it's basically a list of all the different names of the goddess. So the most famous of these is the Lalita Sahasranama, and this is a 1,000 named him to the goddess Lalita Tripura Sundari, who is one of the Mahavidyas. And it's the kind of, I guess, the first of these texts or these 1,000 named hymns. It's considered to be absolutely perfect, this particular one, for various reasons to do with the Sanskrit, but I won't go into that now. But they all have these hymns of names. And what those names, or they're sort of lists of names, which will list all of these different characteristics they have. Now, what we see, and this is the kind of joining element of these goddesses, why we can see them as being kind of separate elements of reality, but also the same element of reality as well, is that we have a lot of names that are repeated in their hymns. So throughout all of the goddesses, there'll be, you know, they may all be referred to, for instance, as, you know, she who is the power of a thousand suns or something like that. You know, we might have a name like that, or, you know, she who is the Mahavidya, for instance, may be one of her names. So there's lots of names that get repeated. And we have, through those names, that mixture of the characteristics that are the fierce characteristics, the benign characteristics. So it's quite interesting that we can relate to the goddesses in these different ways. We can meet these kind of fierce qualities. For instance, if we look at the names of Kali, she's got lots of names that talk about her being sort of bloodthirsty and liking blood, because we have some stories around her with that. So there are some interesting names there, but you kind of have to know the background and to interpret what those names mean. So
sounds a bit like a recipe, you know, you've got various ingredients, and then, you know, however you combine them, you create a different
Definitely.
Yeah.
What's interesting? So I've got some people who've done this course with me for the last 4 years. They just keep signing up each year because they want to do it again. And when we meet the goddess, they will each year they'll say, I've had a completely different experience with the goddess this time, and they've seen them from a different angle because there are so many different angles. So, yeah, so what we do meditations around her characteristics. We practice mantras. We will practice particular reflections that might be related to her characteristics. So I use, where I can, meditations that come from tantras. I use some hatha yoga, although they're not specifically related to hatha yoga. There are definitely some practices within hatha yoga that I can relate to the goddesses because they have a similar power to what I'm looking at with each goddess. So there's various different approaches. I will teach a yoga nidra with the goddesses as well, with her characteristics. So we approach it in lots of different ways. So I basically share these practices, about two practices a week that come through when you're doing a course. So goddess, you're going to get like maybe, well, it depends, around 10 practices probably to do with each goddess. And I also do some more live practices that we dial in for. So we have a live meetup first, which is hybrid. So some people do it via Zoom, some people are in person with me, which is where I introduce the goddess. And then we have an online forum where I share the practices with them throughout the month. And we do a couple of other live dial-in, either meditations or nidras with mantra and various practices. So, yeah, we approach them in lots of different ways. And what has been wonderful about the course as well is that it seems to really awaken creativity in people. I've got one of my students has written these wonderful poems to each goddess, which she's looking to try and get published at some point. They're amazing. I've got several students who've created their own mantras with the mantras that we've been doing. They've recorded mantras and with different rhythms. So it's been really, really wonderful that we've got lots of kind of creativity. I've had people doing paintings. So lots of things get shared within the group. So it's a very kind of communal experience that we go through together, and people will send reflections that they've been out and they particularly, there's a one of the goddesses that we did last month was Bagalamukhi, and she's really associated with this color yellow. So our WhatsApp group that month, people were like, I'm just seeing yellow everywhere and things like that. So it's really great. There's a kind of supportive network for what we go through together, because it's quite powerful, because we're actually really delving into our own experience of being. So it's asking us to move beyond the kind of samskaras and vasanas that we carry with us, these kind of constructs, in a way, these tendencies and traits and habits that we get that kind of form our identity. And we're asking each other to move beyond this sort of limited construct of like being Kadeen. What does it mean to be Kadeen? I've got various preferences and likes and, you know, thoughts and habits that I do, but I want to expand beyond that. I want to know what it is to just be. So this is how we explore with the goddesses.
Gosh, I mean, it just sounds so beautiful. And I know from experience that, you know, any kind of group work, and I've done my fair share of online courses myself and led them myself, and I know that this the community side of things is so special, and to have that support, to know that there's a group there, like if something happens and you go, oh my god, no one else is going to understand this but this group. You know, there's a sense of, you know, you creating a new family as well with that within that group, and you're traveling through the same discovery. And I'm beginning to now understand from what you're saying that how this learning about all the various aspects of these extraordinary goddesses will teach you about yourself, because you will start seeing them reflected in your own life. It's like holding up a mirror to yourself. It's similar to learning about the chakras and learning about what they hold for you. And suddenly you're just like, oh, I see where I'm going wrong. I see what I'm doing here. And this is reflecting straight back at me. And you have all of these beautiful learning moments within just your everyday life. And the whole of life becomes, I can see, like, the whole life just becomes one big kind of learning, sort of like, oh, how can I relate this? And yeah, I think it sounds so beautiful. So I want to go back to something that I said a little while ago about the images, the appearance of all these goddesses. And when I was looking them up, the description, and I'll admit it, I just went to Wikipedia and I just read what was on Wikipedia about them, but they all have these very strong physical appearances, and they are not pretty. They are disheveled. They are, they have very dark or dry skin, or they're green. Isn't one of them's green or blue or So I just wanted to ask you about, why is it that they don't appear like the gorgeous goddess that one might have in one's mind's eye?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and it's really important with them, actually. So there is this representation of everything being divine. So it's very easy for us to see the divine in something beautiful, a beautiful rose or whatever it might be, a beautiful sunset. Oh, we can connect to that divinity, which we often do in nature. But actually, we find it more challenging to see the divinity in something that might be what we consider to be ugly. So there is that element of us recognizing the divinity in everything. And then there are elements there. So you mentioned the disheveled nature. So they often have this sort of disheveled hair. Hair is down, and that's kind of important as well, because that's a subversive quality. So normally women would have their hair, certainly at that time, tied back or braided. That would be the proper way to wear your hair, unless you were somewhere menstruating, so you wouldn't be out in public particularly, or having sex. So this is the time when your hair might be loose. So there's a subversive quality there, that they're kind of outrageously presenting themselves like that. So again, it's asking us to question constructs, societal constructs, and the constructs that we have around, you know, behaviors that we, and obviously we, these things do serve us in day-to-day life. We want to be polite with people, but there's also this challenge that maybe we fall into habit patterns without being fully conscious. So a little subversion can be quite useful, because it helps us to see reality from different vantage points.
I absolutely love that. I think that's a really beautiful point, that, you know, that subversive quality, that's challenging the norm, challenging the conventions that they do, that help us to break out of those patterns and the stereotypes and expectations that we all are, you know, find ourselves living with. So, yeah. Really beautiful. Thank you for that explanation. I'm glad we came back to that.
Thank you.
Tell everybody how they can find you, where, and obviously I'll have all your bits and pieces in the show notes so people can click on, but just say it now for the sake of us.
Oh, I have a website, which I manage myself, so it's very basic. You can find me at Khadine Yoga, so that's khadine yoga.com, and you'll find a link to the Dasha Mahavidya's year immersion course there. So you can also find me through the network called Vajrasati Yoga. So that's the yoga school that I'm part of, and I run a 500-hour teacher training with my partner through Vajrasati Yoga. So you can look me up through that as well. Mm-hmm. So
I mean, I just want to put a little bit of extra, my add in is that Kadine is the most beautiful teacher, and also the meditations that she leads, and she's got the most beautiful voice. I mean, you can tell she's got a beautiful voice, but your sort of your chanting, your mantra voice is just, oh, takes you away. So when is your next course starting? So when can people sign up for the next round?
Okay, well, you can sign up from now, basically, and I run it with the calendar year. So we start again in January. So we run it through January to December. So there'll be 10 live meetups, they're 2-hour sessions. And then we have all of those other practices that come through. And then I do a couple of half an hour dial-ins where we can meet live. I'm thinking of this year doing a little mid-session dial-in just to have a little informal chat with everyone and how it's going. That kind of happens naturally as part of our Google Classroom and WhatsApp groups, but I think it's quite nice to perhaps all just check in together. So yeah, we can start again in January and that will take you through to December. So yeah, it'd be great to have a few new people along.
So this is going to be great Christmas present. I'm thinking who can I ask to get it for me for Christmas? Because you know, you start the new year, and this is one of the things that we all do, isn't it? We're all like, oh, this next year I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to do whatever it is I'm going to do. But actually this as a self developmental learning tool for yourself, especially if you're into yogis, you know, I hope you can all tell how very learned Kadine is. Like, you know, she really does know her stuff. So I fully am excited for your course, and thank you so, so much for spending your time today, Kadine. I really appreciate it.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's been lovely to chat to you. It's obviously we could have chatted all day on this, but hopefully there's enough there to inspire people to at least just go and have a look at the Mahavidyas. Yeah. Tap it into Google and just have a look at those images and see whether or not you feel drawn to them.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, Roseanne.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.